Ask Mr. Gardner, Mr. Alkins, to come forward, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing here today on behalf of the National Car Rental Companies, Hertz, Avis, Budget, et cetera. And what I think Mr. Alkins and I would like to do, we are in a work group with the City of Portland and the local court administrator's office there to see if we can work out a mutually acceptable version of this bill or other solution to the problem with pass-through of parking tickets. And we'd like to simply do that, report that to you, and hopefully come back with a consensus version.
Mr. Alkins, anything you want to add, or?
No, sir.
Okay, so essentially, what Mr. Gardner is telling us is that they are working, they're in a work group right now, in fact, as we speak, and they're trying to work out some of their differences on House Bill 3782. It seemed to me that maybe the best thing for us to do is let them to continue to work on the language of that bill and see if they can't come to some consensus, and then we'll bring this bill back probably early next week.
Great, thank you.
Okay? All right, thank you. Anybody else would like to give us any testimony today on House Bill 3782? Okay, if not, I will close the public hearing for House Bill 3782. Yeah. I do want to let everybody know, so that you know what our planned agenda is today, that we will not be hearing House Bill 3679 or HJR 55 today, and we will not be hearing House Bill 3736.
Oh, can you go over those again, please?
We will not be hearing House Bills 3679, HJR 55, or House Bill 3736.
Thank you.
And as we just stated, House Bill 3782, which we just had a brief hearing on, we will have back next week. We're going to try to let the proponents and the opponents continue to discuss their differences and try to work out some language on the bill. Okay, any questions on any of that from the committee? Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3783. Bonnie, do you want to come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Monty King. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. And we brought 3783 to you to correct a small deficiency in a bill passed last session that we supported and everybody supported that required trade-ins to be paid for after they were traded in. Because there was a glitch in the earlier law a few years back that said a dealer didn't have to pay off a trade-in until that 15 days after the dealer sold the car. So if a dealer took a trade-in, if he didn't sell the trade-in for 3 months, he didn't have to pay it off for 3 months, 15 days. So the law was changed last time. In the change, inadvertently, dealer-to-dealer transactions were also included in that change, so all of a sudden, dealers had to pay each other off 15 days after obtaining the vehicle in a wholesale deal, even though that dealer might not be able to get the title. There is another provision elsewhere that requires the title be provided within 25 days, but all of a sudden, we're making dealers pay for something they can't get a title for also. This bill does not change the rights of the consumers, the end rights at all. We've been over this with the Department of Justice, and they have no problems with it. And I've been working on this for about a year and a half. And also, we've talked with the Department of Motor Vehicles. They have no problem with it either.
Are there any amendments to this bill, Dan? So it's just the straight bill. Okay. Any questions for Mr. King? They're not signed up. Representative Johnson, did you have a question?
No, sir. I was seeing if I had it.
I guess not. I guess that's it, Monty. Thank you. Does anybody else would like to provide testimony on House Bill 3783? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3783. Open a work session on House Bill 3783. Is there a motion? Representative Garrard?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we move House Bill 3783 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves House Bill 3783 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you. I mean, no one else has come. I'm going to make sure that DMV, would they have any reason to oppose or be proponents of this bill?
They have not signed up to testify, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Devlin.
Could Mr. King come back to it?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King, the record, Executive Director of Oregon Independent Auto Dealers.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. King, have you conferred with DMV about this bill? Obviously, they must be aware of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, yes, we have extensively. Phone calls after phone calls, letters, memos, emails. This is the best thing we've come up with in a year and a half of discussions. And they have assured me there's no problem. They do not have a problem with the intent of the bill. The main thing they were concerned about was to make sure the consumers still have all the same rights they have in getting their cars paid off and in getting clear title at the end of any problems, if there are problems. The main problem this has, quite frankly, is when a dealer sells another dealer a car, and the dealer who bought the car doesn't really want to pay that wholesaler for the car, okay, until he gets the title. But that wholesaler who sold the car to the other dealer, all of a sudden he needs some money. He says, hey, if you don't pay me for the car, even though I'm not giving you the title, I'm going to make a written complaint to DMV, and DMV by law has to give him a $1,000 penalty because he didn't pay him for the title, even though he wasn't getting the title. You see what I mean? I mean, that's really the crunch of it, is dealer-to-dealer problems.
Mr. Chairman, follow-up.
So this is really just to protect one dealer against another dealer issuing a complaint where the first dealer hasn't yet, or the second dealer hasn't yet delivered the title.
Mr. Chairman, it's correct, and it'll move the dealer-to-dealer transaction back to where it was 2 years ago, which was inadvertently... All of a sudden, the selling wholesaler dealer all of a sudden has this great big hammer of, you pay me for the car, even though I'm not giving you the title, or I'll complain to DMV and you'll get a $1,000 penalty.
Representative Dillon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification then. DMV, to your knowledge, is fine with the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dillon, they've told me yesterday and today they are fine with the bill. Kelly Taylor was here earlier. She said that. I talked with Pete Shepard at the Department of Justice yesterday. He says he's fine with the bill.
Okay. Other questions? President Walker?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, Mr. King, the question arose because your second paragraph says there's no opposition to the bill known, and the DMV and DOJ have reviewed the bill, but just didn't explicitly say they're okay with it.
Right. They actually have said they're okay with it.
Well, then I'm happy. Thank you.
All right. Okay, thank you, Moni. Anybody else would like to testify? I guess we're in work session, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we have a motion from Representative Garrard. Any other discussion on the motion? Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Bates.
Aye.
Representative Brown.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
Excuse.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Canope.
Excuse.
Representative Crummell. Excuse. Representative Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Walker.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye. House Bill 3783 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Garrard, would you carry the bill, please?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Okay, we will close the work session on House Bill 3783. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2966. Dan, would you give us a brief overview on the bill, please?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2966 establishes that a person who regularly rents, leases, or provides for compensation any real property used to publicly display vehicles for sale is acting as a vehicle dealer without a certificate and is therefore subject to penalty for a Class A misdemeanor. Defines regularly to mean 30 days in a 12-month period. There is a dash one and a dash two amendment that was part of your packet, and Mr. King has now provided a dash three, which encapsulates both the dash one, the dash two, and some further amendment that was required that he's indicated he'd like to explain. This is otherwise known as the park and sell lot bill. A park and sell lot is a location where an owner or operator rents, leases, or provides for compensation display space for another person, a vehicle dealer with or without certification, to sell vehicles to consumers. Current law does not impose responsibility on a park and sell lot owner or operator for sale of a vehicle in which a customer enjoys little or no protection in the sales transaction. The proponent of this measure states that making park and sell activities unlawful for the owner or operator will remove an incentive for sales by persons not certified as vehicle dealers and will provide greater protection for consumers. There is no revenue impact and on the original bill, and you should have in your packet an original impact statement on the original bill.
Okay. Monty, you want to come back up?
Is that what we're on?
Yeah, 37.
2966.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Monty King. I'm executive director of the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. This bill concerns who's a car dealer and who isn't. I was over in Eastern Oregon about a month and a half ago, and there was this lot with about 45 cars on there. I stopped to see whose it was. There's Stan's Auto Sales on the door. The guy comes out and says, can I help you? And I said, yeah, you know, whose car lot is this? He said, well, this isn't a car lot. You know, I just have a couple here. And I found out basically this is the guy who got revoked, his license revoked last October. So instead of a car lot now, he's got a park and sell lot. And this is happening all over. And basically, we figure if you're renting property to sell cars on and you're advertising the fact that there's cars there for sale and you're advertising the availability of that lot to bring customers into that lot, we figure that makes you a car dealer. And they ought to be licensed.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, what if I'm a property owner and I simply lease it to Mr. Crummel here without any knowledge of what he's going to do with it, and suddenly he sets up Jerry's Better Used Cars? Are you coming after me or are you coming after him?
Actually, I think DMV would come after him because he's got Jerry's Used Cars. That, I mean, he's selling cars, right? Okay. Now, if he becomes licensed, then you would not. I mean, there is in the amendments, in the dash three amendments, there is a provision there. If you are renting your property to a licensed vehicle dealer and that's being used as his location, then you don't have to be licensed.
What level of due diligence do I, as the property owner, have to undertake under this bill? I haven't read your testimony because it was just passed out. I'm just trying to ascertain whether or not you're now scrutinizing every property transaction that occurs between a property owner and a willing lessor, the owner perhaps not knowing what the ultimate use is.
Well, if he is renting the property and he's renting the property, if he's renting the property from you, and then he's renting the property to other people who are trying to sell the cars, then I think DMV would go after him. But, you know, that's a really good question. Nobody ever brought that one up before. But somebody there is a car dealer. I think you admit somebody there is a car dealer, and somebody should be licensed.
Well, I just want to make sure we're giving clear direction to DMV who to come after. And you not having contemplated the scenario that I just laid out and not having an answer for it is a little bit worrisome for me in supporting this bill.
Mr. Chairman, if I might respond, I think the same would be true if you rented property and somebody started raising marijuana on it. or did other things, or, you know, any kind of illegal activity, you know, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what the responsibility of a owner of a property is for having somebody do an illegal activity on that property. So I don't know that bigger question.
Representative Crummell might make more money in your scenario than selling cars. I'm teasing you.
I would say.
So I understand, Representative Johnson, your concern is allows someone who's not a licensed dealer to rent a property and they put cars on there, and they're in essence in violation of this bill, the language of this bill. They simply didn't know that this person wasn't a licensed dealer.
Yeah. What level of burden is put on me if I just have a piece of property that I want to rent to someone?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I think the fact that you have a legal document showing that the property, the use of the property and the rights of the property is now with Jerry, I mean, I think that puts it on him. And if he's now subletting that, he's acting as the illegal dealer. Because you're not involved in the renting to the person who's bringing the vehicle onto the lot. I don't think that's, you know, I don't know how far you can go down and how specific you have to get in language, but I don't think that's there, and I don't think DMV would ever try to get you on an unlicensed dealer penalty on that type of a situation. I just can't believe that.
I understand what you're doing here. I'm just looking for the devil in the details.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair? I just wanted to clear one thing. I'm probably not reading this properly. If you have family vehicles and sell more than 5 in 1 year, does that make you a dealer? I mean, that's kind of vague there. And if you have 4 or 5 kids and a set of parents and people are changing cars or some died, you might find yourself easily selling and buying more than 5 cars in 1 year.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, you are looking at current language of the statutes, not new language. The current statute basically says up through the first 5 vehicles that you have, and I'm not a lawyer, but that's my understanding, up through the first 5 vehicles that you have for personal household use, you do not have to prove you're a dealer.
I don't know if that answers your
question. That you're not a dealer. If you sell 6 or more vehicles in a year's time, you could be asked by the state to prove that these are vehicles you've had of use for your household or family purposes. And if you, of course, can prove that, then you are not a dealer. That's current statutes, and that's current law.
But that would affect them. This new law would affect them.
Did this new, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, no, I don't think this new section would change that at all. This just talks about who is a dealer, who is bringing buyers and sellers together at properties. Now, I figure a person who has a 36-foot sign that says, buy here, you know, cars for sale or something, that's probably a dealer. And this guy over in Eastern Oregon who's got Stan's Auto Sales on his door, I mean, all he did was change spots or something. I mean, and that's exactly what's happening. There are people who are being revoked and kicked out of the business, are right back in business, and it's getting around.
I understand that problem. I want to make sure we have an inadvertent situation.
They're dash threes, too.
Are there a dash three?
Yeah.
There's a dash three?
There's a dash three. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, there is a dash three. It's attached to my testimony.
And it says here. Mr. Chair?
Representative Johnson?
I think the dash threes address it. I haven't read the dash threes, and it's just now been pointed out to me that it says, and participates in advertising that vehicles on the property are available for public purchase.
Yes, ma'am.
I think my situation is resolved by your amendments.
So the situation now, Representative Johnson, what you're saying is that the person who rents the property would have to also be participating in advertising that these vehicles there are for sale.
If I read the dash threes correctly, that's exactly what it says.
So it's not just you just passively rented the property, now you're participating in the advertising. Is that right, Representative? Okay. I don't see the dash three, so I don't know where they are.
Oh, they're under this.
They're attached to,
Is that where they are?
They're attached to the testimony.
Oh, you're hiding them behind your testimony. How surreptitious of you.
Sorry.
If you want them red.
Okay, does everybody see where that language is?
It's in the first one.
Okay, other questions? I guess I have a question, Monty. I mean, I think what we're doing here is we're saying that a landlord is a person who is acting as a vehicle dealer without a certificate because they rent property to someone who is selling cars on that property without a vehicle certificate. Now we've added this qualification and also participating in advertising. I guess, what does that mean? Does participating in advertising mean that I know that the dealer, the unlicensed dealer, has put signs up saying good deals, used cars?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a very good question of where's the line here. You yourself could let somebody park their car on your property with a sign in it there, and that doesn't make you a dealer. You could even charge them $25 and it doesn't make you a dealer. But if you put a sign up and says, it says spaces for rent to sell your vehicle, that makes you a dealer because you're advertising to bring in people into that lot to sell their car. That's where the line is. And that's one of the things that DMV talked about was, if we don't make that qualification of advertising, of actively trying to bring people in to that lot, then they would have to go out and look at every car on every lot, on every dirt road, to see if they're a dealer or not. And that's just way too big. This lot in Eastern Oregon I was at, I mean, they have up on this reader board, you know, that spots for sale, you know, spots for rent to sell your car. There's one in Newburgh, 30-something foot sign. I mean, they're actively trying to bring people in. We have a very strong consignment law in Oregon, and it's to make sure the people who are selling cars and bringing cars to other people to help sell them are doing it in the right way. Park and sell lots go right around that whole consignment law. And, I mean, we're not only having a place where curbers congregate on weekend, illegal dealers, but we're also helping people avoid the consignment laws, and we're helping failed dealers. Dealers we don't want in business or you don't want in business, we're helping them create new kinds of car lots. And it's a brand new phenomenon. They're popping up all over. I know Cincinnati now has three of them.
So, Mr. Chair?
President Crummel?
Okay, now I'm a little confused again. I drive I-5 every day, and there's a big sign at Volcano Stadium. And it says Saturdays 10 to 4, 10 to 3, whatever it is. Car fair, or car, it's not, it doesn't even really say car fair. I think it just says autos for sale or something.
Your car,
anyway, it's like a swap meet type of a thing, I think, where you can, or I don't know, that's pretty old language. But you can go and take your car there and park it. Now, I don't know if you have to stay there with your car or not. I would assume that you do, but I don't know. But you can, and they're saying, you know, if you want to buy a car, come in here. So would this bill make that illegal?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummel, it wouldn't make that illegal. It would require them to either do one of two things, either get their own dealer's license or have a licensed vehicle dealer who is now legal go over there and make that his supplemental location. And then that could be a place where that activity could happen. There's no reason why any of these people with his park and sell lots can't get a regular car dealer right now and make that a supplemental location for $90 for 3 years, soon to be more, and have that as a regular dealer location and have those car sales happen under the auspices of a licensed dealer so that they're legal. So, yeah, they can do it one of two ways. One's really cheap, the other one's be a car dealer. But yeah, they're bringing in people, they're advertising it, they're doing it on a regular basis, they're bringing buyers and sellers together. That's a car dealer. That is probably the most high profile of the park and sells in the state of Oregon, but that also is one of those two.
But follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
To me, a person that's acting as a car dealer is a person that's actively going out and seeking the buyer, and actually selling the vehicle. If the owner, landowner is just saying, I see an opportunity here, and if a person wants to sell their car and they want to give me $20 for being able to park their car on my lot for the day, and you know, there might be people come by and there might not be people come by. I'm having a hard time making the connection how is the owner of Volcano Stadium being a car dealer if, and I don't know if they require the sellers to stay with their vehicles or not. Now, if they don't, and if they're actually brokering the deal, then I agree with you there. They're acting as a car dealer. But if it's just basically a place where, you know, somebody can come and set their car there, and if they want to stay with the vehicle and sell it, it's okay with me. I'm having a hard time making the connection how the landowner in that case is acting as a car dealer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krummel, they're in the business of bringing buyers and sellers together. If they're in business, they should be licensed along with the rest of the industry. If it's a decision of the state of Oregon that people selling cars or bringing buyers and sellers together shouldn't be licensed, then there's about 3,100 people out there who are going to be real happy. But those people are in business. They are paying huge amounts of money. We just agreed to, a 300% increase in dealer fees to help regulate people, to make sure they're doing the things the right way. And all of a sudden, over this last 2 years, we have this new phenomenon of how you can be a car dealer without having to be licensed, without having to have any consumer protection, without having any regulation, without having to have insurance for the people who come onto the property. I mean, I think it's pretty clear in the law right now, and the DMV doesn't agree with me, on page 3 of my testimony. Let's see, wait a second. On page 1, excuse me. Under 822.005, what's a dealer? It says, acts as any type of an agent for the owner of a vehicle to sell the vehicle, or acts as any type of agent for a person interested in buying a vehicle to buy a vehicle, okay? Or under B, displays a new or used vehicle or whatever for sale. Any of those things are a dealer. I think these people are already doing all this stuff, but they're bending their way all the way through this stuff, you know, to avoid it. Now, there are people who, I mean, these big lots, big park and sell lots, those cars are there for weeks and months. There's nobody there. We know of people who are actually helping people do the paperwork in their office. They provide the 226 applications and all the other paperwork for these supposed people to come in and do it by themselves. This is not just Volcano Stadium. I mean, if they want to do it right, they should have a dealer there or operating under the auspices of a dealer. But what we have is a wide-open thing here. It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and you're going to see these lots with hundreds and thousands of vehicles. And at the same time, license the good guys. Our business is going down because you got car dealers out there who are not licensed anymore. They're not paying their fair share. Are they paying their taxes? You know, the guy I saw over in Eastern Oregon, he admitted to me he has some of his own vehicles in that area. And he's a guy who's been kicked out of the business.
Okay. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. King, didn't we have a bill similar to this earlier?
I'm sorry?
Didn't we have a bill similar to this earlier in this committee that you presented to us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, it was on the agenda one day, but we never heard it.
But I remember taking notes, and we talked about you could sell your own car, it didn't, you know... That was Curvers, okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, that's now in the Senate Transportation Committee.
Well, yeah. I feel sorry for me there, but, okay. I just was having deja vu, and I was wondering why I didn't have any notes in my file, and this sounded so familiar. All right, thank you for clearing that up.
Bonnie, why are you going from 30 days to 10 days?
Mr. Chairman, there are other provisions in other areas of you get 10 days to do this or that, and we felt 10 days was enough. In the case of if you only did it two days a month, you'd still have it 24 days a year. We felt if you're going to do it and you're going to do it more than 10, you ought to be licensed. If you're going to be making money and you're going to be in business, be in business. We felt 10 was a lot better to make sure the people who are doing it. So people didn't start up a thing for 3 weeks, take a bunch of money, and then skip out.
So you think regularly used would, you know, 10 days per year?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman?
You're defining regularly used to mean at least 10 days per year.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I haven't had the opportunity to read these latest amendments because we just got them. What's the enforcement mechanism for this, and at what cost to DMV? I don't know if DMV signed up to testify.
Well, yeah, I think we do have a fiscal on this, don't we?
Mr.
Do you comment publicly about that?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, the fiscal on the original bill shows for the next biennium a total of other funds of $170,000 in fiscal expenditure. And then an approximation in garnering civil penalties, imposing civil penalties of $53,000. The effect on hiring positions would be two, it looks to me as though it's two people. They would have to, or I guess one and a half by this formula. One person for one and a half people to investigate. Well, it's $170,000 minus a potential of $53,000 in revenue.
That sounds just amazing to me. Well, do you want to follow up on that?
No, thank you.
Mr.
Do you want to comment on that?
Yes, sir, I would. Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, DMV is already supposed to go after Curbers. That's my understanding, at least. Now, there is nothing in statute that really says you're supposed to go after Curbers, but there's all the statutes that say this is a Curber penalty are in their statutes and their rules and stuff. They're already supposed to go after Curbers. I would not expect any additional staff whatsoever to be doing this. I mean, they are already going down the same road, looking at the same cars. They're already going into some of these locations and doing Curber searches already for illegal dealers who are trying to hide among the park and sell car lots. I know they're doing it because I've talked to them. There's going to be no new staff, no new anything. We just like to maintain what they're doing now and make perhaps operate better, and we want to help them do that. And we will report this stuff. If these people are actually going to be in business doing this, they're going to be paying their fees also, just like all the rest of the car dealers. So there's money coming in there that I don't think has been mentioned. Plus, I mean, if they got to be licensed, I think you're going to see some of them go away.
I guess I do have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Representative Johnson.
What are the origins of the three sets of amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, the origins of the three sets of amendments, and if you look at the first page of my testimony down at the bottom, the dash three amendments are explained there. And the dash one was based, we put all the amendments into one. So the lowers of 10 days from 30 days, that's just because it's 30 days was an awful long time if you're doing it every other day or every other weekend. So we wanted 10 instead. We've debated this extensively in our association all over the state. The advertising came from some conversations I had with some DMV staff people. They thought if we limit it to people who are actually advertising it, then we won't, they won't have to go look at every car that's parked along the road, only someplace where there's a sign. And if there's cars for sale and a sign that says, you know, come here for your cars, and go in and ask, are you renting this property? And if they are, they said, well, you gotta be licensed. That's pretty easy. I don't think there's any problem there.
What if they say no? I can understand how there may be an additional regulatory burden on DMV. Not everybody you talk to tells the truth. And I can easily see how there'd be an additional regulatory burden, and I hope that Ms. Taylor is signed up to testify so that we can at least understand the agency's perspective on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I want to point out that the figures you heard before were before the second amendment that's in that little list of mine, before the advertising limitation. So it's going to be quite significantly lower than whatever that is because of that limitation where they have to also not only be renting it, but also advertising it.
And with all respect, Mr. King, I still think just on the face of it that this is going to put a regulatory burden on the agency. And I'm not convinced that it's not going to be without some cost to get it sorted out.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, probably, but that's what they're there for, and that's what we're paying for. I mean, we're paying a couple million dollars a year in dealer fees, and this is one of the things they're supposed to be doing, is going out looking for bad dealers and curbers and people operating illegally. They're a dealer or they're not. We think they are.
Okay. Mr. Brock.
Monty, I got one real problem with this. I keep wondering where it's going to go. Do we start making the owner of land responsible if somebody wants to come out and sell Christmas trees or any, and I know most county, there are city and county ordinances against merchants setting up and doing that kind of thing, but it could be T-shirts, it could be Christmas tree, it could be anything. It kind of bothers me. From the standpoint, are we opening a door here that we're going to have to address again and again?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrard, I agree with you, and I'd like to go back to the days of 1945 and 1936 when cars were sold with a handshake and a piece of paper. The people of the state and in the country have decided that cars are of critical importance to the economy, to everything we do as a society, that the potential for dishonesty is huge in this industry, odometer clocking, taking cars, putting them back together in pieces. I mean, you think of all the things that are going on, okay? Just for an example, they estimate that 9% of all lease returns by companies in the United States have had between 2,000 and 4,000 miles clocked on them, in other words, run back. Now, you just think of that one thing and all those cars, you're talking billions of dollars. Cars are the most important thing, except for a house, that we do. We title them. I mean, there's huge rules on it. It's a big business. If you can make an extra $300 or $500 on every car, you can make a lot of money. If we're going to regulate the car business, let's do it evenly and not let these people over here do something that all the rest of the people can't do just because they don't, you know, because they say they're not dealers. They are dealers. There's no doubt about it. This is a dealer. He's bringing a buyer and a seller together. He's doing it for compensation. And if we don't want to regulate dealers anymore, then fine. But this isn't a property thing. This is a how do you sell your car thing.
Okay. Any other questions? Monty, thank you. Does anybody else would like to give testimony on House Bill 2966?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like Ms. Taylor to come up if she wants.
More than welcome. She wasn't signed up, though.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation, and I apologize for not signing up. There's a couple of things about the bill in its original form, even with the amended version, and I too just got the dash three, so I don't have a chance to do an amended fiscal. I called staff, was out in the hall calling staff to see if there was any way they could tell me what the difference would be, and there wasn't on the spot. The thing that makes this a little different is we are talking about not the person who's selling the car, not the person who's displaying the car. We're talking about the property owner. And so to try to prove that you received compensation, and I'm not even sure what all compensation could include. Is that a bartering? Is that, you know, you got some produce swapped for a farm field that's empty at one point? I mean, we really don't know what, you know, what all that could entail. It's that, it's the how many days and 12-month period, trying to get into the records to prove that well, even having access to the records of an owner agreement of renting or leasing or providing compensation, the investigation, trying to figure out, prove that they got compensation, mm-hmm. prove that it's happened so many days within a 12-month period, that's what makes this difficult, and that's what makes the cost. It's different than an investigation where you're just proving that I sold a car. Now you're proving that I told Representative Walker, you know, I'll lease you my land, and I know it happened more than 10 days in a 12-month period, and now I know Monty's trying to bring it down by adding the participate. I'm not sure how I prove that she participated in the advertising. And so it isn't that we can't get there. I just, you know, it isn't as straight line, I guess, if you will, proving that this person sold this car. Now you've got a third party that may not even been around. They may be an out-of-state owner. I don't know. So that's part of the complexity in this. It's a little different.
Didn't we increase fines earlier this session on curbers?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think that's the bill that Monty referred to that's in Senate Transportation.
Okay. And how much additional revenue did that bill raise?
Mr. Chair, I don't remember. I don't know. I know for this bill, with the civil penalties, were $25,000. We don't, and even when we assess a civil penalty, many times people don't pay, and it's difficult to collect. But that's where the revenue is from this bill, is from the civil penalties.
Okay. Other questions? So, do you guys have a position on this bill?
Mr. Chair, unless the commission has taken a position, we do not. We stay neutral, and they have not on this bill.
And where did the fiscal come from?
Mr. Chair, it came from the department.
It didn't go through legislative fiscal?
Yes, it goes from the department to legislative fiscal and then to you all.
So this came from legislative fiscal?
Right. From us, right.
It's just on the original.
Representative Crummell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, Ms. Taylor, I'm trying to kind of make the connection here. So let's take the situation at Volcano Stadium, Saturday morning, afternoons, they open it up. You can bring your car in there, whether you stay with it or not. As you read this as you read the current statute, are they in violation of the law as a dealer because they're allowing people, you know, I mean, I assume that it's sell by owner. Like I said, I haven't stopped there, but, you know, can take my car in there and put it there, and if it's got a for sale sign and a phone number to call, and if people come by and they see it and they want to call, I can go and show it to them. If I'm the one selling the car, would the landowner, is the landowner being an illegal dealer either as you read this new statute or as you as the current statute is?
Mr. Chair and Rivers Crummell, if the property owner has nothing to do with the sale of the vehicle under today, they're not involved. This does bring the property owner into it. You know, if you park your car on an Albertsons lot during the day with a for sale sign and it telling you to call you, Albertsons is not a dealer. Now, under this bill, if somehow Albertsons got compensation for that and participated in the advertising, they would be. I don't think Albertsons is getting compensation from those people, but a farmer or a property owner or somebody, a retired person who has a little blank piece of land over at the coast or something and they're not using it and they want to rent it out to somebody, and they, under the bill, the way it's drafted, if they receive any kind of compensation for it, and if it's over 10 days in a 12-month period, which again is part of that trying to track all that, and we can prove that, then yeah, you would be guilty of being an unlicensed vehicle dealer. Now, with the dash threes, it brings in the mix of, did you participate in the advertising? And I don't know what that will take to prove whether or not you participated in the advertising. But what this does is brings, excuse me, is brings in the property owner. Whereas now, a property owner is not in it unless the property owner is the one selling the car.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
So if I'm, so under the current statute, if I'm letting people come onto my property and sell their cars, and they're still for sale by owner,
mm-hmm.
And I advertise, say, yeah, you know, Representative Bates and Representative Brown and Montes Anderson, all you representatives, bring your cars over here and sell them so you can, you know, afford to stay in office.
Mm-hmm.
Bring them over to my place and you can put your car here and let people know that it's that they're for sale and all that kind of stuff. Am I in violation of the current statute?
Today?
Yeah.
You mean you're just telling people they can park a car on your land?
Yeah.
But you're not participating in selling it?
No. It's for sale by owner. I mean, if they want to sell their car and they want a place to
you're
put it,
you're private Albertsons at this point.
Yeah, I have an Albertsons type lot, high traffic, lots of.
Yeah, no, you're not, because you're not the one selling the car.
Okay.
This bill would bring you in and say you are participating. This bill would call you an unlicensed dealer, and I would be if you didn't get yourself licensed, and I found that you were guilty, and I could prove that you've received compensation and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. 10 days, 12-month period, 30 days, 12 months, whatever, then you would be an unlicensed dealer and you get a civil penalty.
Okay. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, there's been, I just want to clarify, with the funding of business regulations, it's changed, it just recently is changing, and the reason it is because of that Attorney General review recently about what we can and can't use highway funds for. And with the business regulation program, the fees that are collected from the licensing are to pay for the program. And if there are additional things added to a program, be it this or anything else, we have to make sure it stays within what we've got, or we can't use highway funds. So it just, you know, we just have to be careful and reflect on the fiscals what it will cost. And if we can do it with inside of what we collect, great. And if we can't, we can't.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anybody else who wants to give testimony on House Bill 2966? Not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2966, open a work session on House Bill 2764. I should have some amendments. I think we have dash three amendments. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have a staff measure summary for 2764. We held a public hearing on the 16th of March and had intended to since then, but in fact some amendments were in the works and weren't quite ready. You have before you should have a 17-page dash three amendment to this bill. I've encapsulated the amendment in the staff measure summary for you. Also, for your information, it has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact, but a statement's not been issued yet as we just received the dash three amendments. Mr. John McCulley, who is the original requester of the bill, is also here as well and has provided you a handout that indicates in the first two pages a section-by-section detailing of what the bill does. In fact, the last page of Mr. McCulley's handout, if I could refer you to that, shows what you would have seen, the changes of what you would have seen on the 16th of March. And it says changes made since the Dash 1 amendments. When we first held public hearing and work session on this bill, you saw the bill with the dash one amendments. Now, in fact, you're seeing the bill with the dash three amendment, which, in fact, clarifies a lot of the issues that were brought up previous to that. Just prior to this meeting, I did inquire and receive, with a lot of appreciation to legislative fiscal, some verbal impact, verbal fiscal impact, if you will. So this is not official. But in fact, they indicate that if implemented, dash three amendment to this bill, very similar to the bill that we just talked about, would have a requirement, an additional requirement in DCBS of two people for licensing and investigation at an approximate cost of $160,000. Offsetting that, however, would be revenues estimating 4,000 people a year. Filing for registration as loan originators at $50 approximately per person, would raise approximately $200,000 in revenues. So, in fact, if all 4,000 registered, there would be a net effect of more revenue than expense. With that, I'll let you go ahead and scan the staff measure summary. In fact, it does look quite dramatically different than the original bill in that it now places DCBS in the regulatory role of this registration program, establishing initial and continuing education requirements. It retains the original bill's requirement for a criminal background check, and it allows an experiential waiver up until the 2nd of January 2004. So it phases in those folks who've already got the experience. And it grants DCBS rulemaking authority in supervising the loan originators, the mortgage service and collection, and giving appropriate notice of a hearing. With that, Mr. McCulley is here if any of the representatives would like him to explain any of the amendments or answer any questions.
Yeah, John, why don't you come forward and also briefly talk about the Dash 3 amendments and then respond to any questions.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Brokers. First, Mr. Chair, if I might, I'd like to extend appreciation to the committee for the patience they have shown in dealing with all of the lobbying that's gone on with this bill. I know that it's difficult to deal with issues where there's disagreement within the industry, and I just appreciate the, like I say, the patience that you've shown in letting us explain our various positions on it. The amendments that you have before you were developed after the initial hearing and try to respond to some of the issues raised by legislative counsel, to the opponent of the bill, and to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And if you would like, I could tell you in the amendment specifically where the changes were made. Beginning on page 1 of the bill, lines 15 and 16, the language was tightened up there. The words "that is determined by the amount borrowed or the terms and conditions agreed to by the mortgage loan borrower" were added, and the term on line 17, "negotiating," that was added in place of the word "communicating." So we're trying to tighten up that language. On page 2,
so you're saying on page 1, the language "that is determined by the amount borrowed," it requires that this is some kind of a compensation system that involves some kind of a commission.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Either commission paid or a flat fee that is charged.
Okay.
On page 2, the exemption or who this does not apply to, we had used the word in the Dash 1 amendments before the word "clerical" on line 2, the word "entirely." That word has been taken out. And so that it adds a little broader exception for those who would be covered by the bill. Proceeding to page 7 now. On line 24, the Dash 1 amendments had the supervisor and the loan originator certifying under section or sub A there. We have taken out loan originator, so now it is the supervisor that does that certification. And that answered a concern that legislative counsel had with assigning a responsibility to two different people.
I'm sorry, what was the old language?
The old language read "supervisor and loan originator shall."
Oh, where it says the supervisor shall.
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. The next change, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is on page 9. In line 6, sub 8 there. In the Dash 1 amendments, there was language related to a loan originator working for more than one mortgage lender. We have amended that so that it is very clear that the loan originator can only work for one mortgage lender at a time. The previous language, I think, was confusing in that area. On that same page, on line 12, after the word provide, we had used the word in the dash one amendments of certify or provide certification, excuse me, of that during the preceding 2 years.
I'm sorry, where is that, John?
Okay, line 12 on page 9.
Mm-hmm.
Well, line the word 12. Certification has been replaced with evidence satisfactory to the director in trying to address the concern of DCBS.
Okay.
On page 10, line 23, the word may, you see there, replaces the word shall. In the prior language, there was the mandate that the department notify the supervisor. This language now makes it discretionary on the part of DCBS and also adds language that DCBS would notify the licensee as well as the supervisor. At times, they may be different. The supervisor is a living being. The licensee is a corporation. The department was concerned that at some point the supervisor may be incapacitated and unable to receive that notice. So we added the language licensee, which is the corporation, and supervisor, which is the natural person.
Why may instead of shall?
Mr. Chair, there may be a circumstance where the supervisor or licensee is under investigation as well as the loan originator that works for that firm. This gives the department discretion in notification in that circumstance where there may be the entire business under investigation and not just the loan originator.
And presumably this complaint's coming from a customer.
Mr. Chair, it could be coming from a customer, yes.
Or it could be a competitor.
Yes.
Okay.
On that same page, Mr. Chair, on line 26, legislative council had raised the issue that there wasn't a clear guideline on when the director was to notify the licensee and supervisor about the conclusion of the investigation. So the language upon the conclusion on line 26 was added to clarify that.
Gotcha.
And also on line 27, the language license, I believe there's a typographical error.
Missing an E.
It should be licensee and supervisor.
Everybody might want to correct that. On page 10, line 27, the word license needs to have an E added. It should be licensee. Okay.
The next change, Mr. Chair, would be on page 14. Beginning at line 12, this is the section that requires the licensee, which is the mortgage banker or mortgage broker, to supervise diligently the mortgage-related activities of the loan originator. In the previous amendments, we had language related to independent contractor there. It was our intent to make certain that independent contractors could not be in this business or operate as independent contractors in this business, but it led to a lot of confusion. So we are recommending in the dash three amendments that all the references to independent contractor in that subsection 15 be eliminated.
Okay, so you eliminated an independent contractor from the language there.
Correct, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. And Mr. Chair, those are the amendments that have been made from the dash ones. One other I should mention, the effective date in the dash one amendments was January 1st, 2003. We received a lot of feedback from the industry that they think this should be in effect as soon as possible without an emergency clause. So we have deleted a reference to an effective date which means that when it is approved by the legislature, it would become effective January 1st, 2002.
January 1st, 2002.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. McCulley on the Dash 3 amendments or anything within the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Mr. McCulley, this has been an extremely difficult bill for me. And it's some people have gotten very personal about it, which I don't appreciate. You have not. And I appreciate you've made this a professional situation with you, and you haven't gotten personal with me, and I appreciate that. I don't know for certain which way to vote in this bill at times. I've gone back and forth a dozen times a day. You wrote a letter April 10th that said the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities Department of Consumer and Business Services believes that with some additional changes to House Bill 2764, the division can support as one way to deal with the problem and instruct us to call Jim Kruger. I have not had an opportunity to do that, and I would like to have the time to do that and research this bill further. This is on your letterhead. If I were to call Mr. Kruger, do you have any idea what he'd say at this point, or do you feel it's inappropriate for me to ask you that question?
Well,
Mr. Kruger's here, I think.
Mr. Kruger could answer that question, and I don't know if you have in your files information from DCBS that indicates their position on the bill that I think I have restated in the letter that I provided to the committee. But Mr. Kruger would be the appropriate person to ask that question.
Mr. Kruger, could you come forward, please?
Mm-hmm. There's no letter that I have been talking about.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Kruger. I'm the program manager in the Department of Consumer and Business Services, Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, responsible for administration of the Mortgage Lender Program, Chapter 59. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Representative Bates, would you?
First, I'll ask a question that you may not be able to answer and may not be the answer to my satisfaction, because I really need more time to think about this whole thing. I feel very rushed at this point. Does your department have a position on this bill?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, if I could answer it this way and provide just a little bit of background. As you probably know, this was a bill that was requested by the mortgage brokers. It was not requested by the department. When we first reviewed the first draft of the bill, we determined that we, in order to administer this bill in a cost-effective manner, an efficient manner, it would need to be amended. And we were pleased to be able to work with the mortgage brokers on amendments that we feel now make it easier to administer the bill should you decide to pass it. We believe that with the amendments, this bill is one way of getting at a problem that exists. And if it's the decision of the legislature to go this route, then we can implement it, and further, we can implement it within the new time frame that is in Dash 3 amendments.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I recognize there's a problem here, and you say this is one way. And again, this may be an inappropriate question to ask you. It's something you may want to think about and need more time on, too. This is one way. Are there better ways to deal with this problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, I would need more time to determine if there were better ways. This is one way of getting at it, but I don't know if it's the best way or if there are better ways without a lot more thought and a lot more discussion with both the mortgage bankers and the mortgage brokers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gosselin?
Thank you. You indicated it would make it easier to administer. Does the department have an opinion on this bill or a position on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, other than what I have already stated, I am not in a position to express an opinion of the department on this bill in any other detail.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I have been inundated with emails, surveys, phone calls, and it seems like there's a lot of support amongst your industry for this bill. I mean, and I actually pulled out my district out of the entire array of material, and the tally is 16-4 and one against, so, you know, the support from my area is pretty strong. I guess what makes it hard, and Representative Bates, I think, expressed my feeling on this as well, is that in statute, the brokers and the bankers are entangled. And so I guess my first question is there any way that you, because the, obviously your industry wants it very much, and it's another industry that just happens to be intertwined with UN statute that has reservations about it. You can't do a notwithstanding, it doesn't include them. Is there any way we can disentangle this, or is this the best we can come up with at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, we had tried to address that earlier in the process to see if there was a way to do that. And Mr. Kruger can comment on this, but there are brokers who do banking activities. There are bankers who are brokers, and there is no bright line to do that. Now, I suppose that the legislature could say, notwithstanding, and leave it to the regulator to determine who is where in that system, and that is an option to look at.
Maybe I could hear from the department on your perspective.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as John has indicated, it is very difficult to distinguish one activity from another because of the way the industry has developed over the last 10 or 12 years. I would be reluctant to say there is no way. I think that probably there may be a way where you could distinguish them based on a percentage of the business activity of a banking business as opposed to a brokering business, maybe that sort of thing. And it would take some work and would need some detail, and it probably would not be flawless, but it could be manageable.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The other question that I had is that there are several places, as I'm looking through the Dash 3 amendments, where the department will, by rule, actually determine certain parameters or standards or criteria within the concepts that are put forth in this bill. I'm looking specifically at page 7, the very bottom, line 31, and then it goes on to the top of page 8, where it says the director may conduct a criminal background check on the applicant. The director may reject an application upon finding that the applicant has engaged in activity demonstrating unfitness to engage in mortgage lending activity. The director may also engage in application for conduct described in the ORS or for good cause as determined by rule. Could you give us a sense about the process that you will use to come up with rules that will then define standards where you may be able to actually reject someone's application?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, it's not as daunting as it might appear in the language there because we already have gone through that process for the mortgage bankers and the mortgage brokers themselves. And the grounds that we would use for registrants or loan officers would be very similar. And it would involve a formal rulemaking process with hearing and comment period. And we would look to other programs that we administer and our experience in those programs, for example, the securities law, which has quite a history on providing reasonable grounds for denying, revoking, or suspending a license. And in addition, there are other statutes on the books that provide direction to us that say you may not base a revocation or suspension or denial based solely on a criminal conviction. It has to have some nexus to the activity that they're seeking the license for or the registration.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one more follow-up. And then am I to assume that the Administrative Procedures Act would then dictate the process if you were to deny an application that someone could appeal that process and move through the system into the courts or whatever?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am not aware of all of the problems. Obviously, you are. What I want to know is how many loan transactions do you think there are in the state? Then how many complaints does your department get now? Can you shed any light on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know the number of loan transactions. That's not a figure that we track. It's in the hundreds of thousands.
Okay,
sure.
That's good enough for me.
As to the number of complaints that we receive, I don't have the figures. I can get them for you. It is not numerous. It is probably 100 or less.
100 or less?
Yes, ma'am. But the problem is when we deal with a complaint, it may consist of information that we've gathered from numerous
consumers who have been harmed by the same individual or the same licensee. So one complaint, I'm thinking of one, for example, that we completed in 98, I think it was. There were about 438 consumers that were harmed by this one licensee, but that was counted as one complaint.
Okay. In my mind, I'm just trying to see, we have hundreds of thousands of loan transactions and less than 100 complaints, and we are going to be setting up a huge, I feel, bureaucracy or registration system. I think it would change what you have to do as a department, correct? Significantly?
There would be a fairly substantial computer programming that we would have to do in order to implement this program. It would take two full-time equivalent employees to process and do the background checks and track the education, and that's a substantial impact on a program that currently employs, not counting myself, four full-time equivalents, one of which is a support staff person, one of which is a senior compliance officer in charge of enforcement, and two of whom do examinations and review applications for the licensees currently.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I might clarify, I believe we have provided some information to the committee talking about the number of transactions that occurred, and I think it was less than 100,000, 70,000 sticks in my mind, but I can verify that for you.
And we had how many complaints?
There are, Mr. Chair, I believe there were but 300. It was not a huge number, Mr. Chair,
but it was
less than 100 complaints. But
let's get this clarified, because I do remember testimony on that earlier.
But it affected many people. I mean,
we have a preliminary fiscal on this, by the way, and it's preliminary. But it looks like it would take two FTE, $160,000 per biennium in terms of the fiscal cost. And it appears that the licensing provisions here would bring in, is it $200,000? Is that right? About $200,000. So there's sufficient money in the fees here to cover the fiscal impact, it would appear. Did we have a clarification on that?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, now this is information provided by our organization based on information we developed, I think, through title companies. In the year 2000, for example, approximately 70,000 mortgages, 69,669, complaints about 180.
180?
180.
180 complaints.
And that, of course, doesn't take into account, as Mr. Kruger testified, any one complaint could involve many, quote, victims. But nonetheless, those are the...
Complaint could be about an individual, and it could involve several transactions. Is that what we're saying?
That's correct, sir.
Okay. So, I mean, this could be several hundred mortgages could be involved in these complaints, very conceivably.
Yes, sir.
Okay. See, Representative Garrard, Representative Montefinos, are you done?
Yes, for now.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCauley, when I got up this morning, I was a resounding no on this bill. And it's through my own fault, but I have become a tennis ball today. And
join the crowd.
I'm not real happy with that at all. And so I've decided to blame both sides. Because there is a problem here, and I've heard from my constituents that this is not the best way to solve it. So I have a concern there that we may be rushing to judgment from the standpoint of doing something that, if we took our time, we might be able to do it a little better. It really bothers me that we haven't been able to come together and determine that. And I don't know some of the rights we have on this committee or anything else, but I would sure like to see this bill delayed and to give both parties more of an opportunity, and I'm following up with Representative Bates here, that both parties be given more time to work on this to see if there is a better way. And that's what I would feel comfortable with tonight. That's called a net ball, by the way.
Is there a question then?
Yes, there was, but you missed it.
Okay, Representative Devlin.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I have a question first. In the fiscal statement, which we don't have for this, but we kind of understand what will be in terms of revenue and in terms of what the cost will be. Normally, when we start any sort of board or we start any sort of operation, whether it's registration, licensure, there has to be a built-in, basically, I'm trying to search for a term here, a loan from the state, so to speak, because it'll be a certain time before you receive registration, payments, et cetera, et cetera. So it's quite typical. I think the usual number is about $50,000 to $100,000 that the state has to advance, and then that's paid back. Do you anticipate that that will be the case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, we do not. The mortgage lender program has a very healthy, if not too healthy, ending fund balance. And as a matter of fact, in this last 12 months, we've reduced their fees substantially to get that fund balance down. The reason why the fund balance is so large is because of the large number of licensees that we have. When this program was implemented in about 1994, we thought maybe we'd have 250, 300 licensees. Today we have approximately 1,800 licensed locations of 1,100 licensees. That is 900 branch offices. And that resulted in a very large ending fund balance. And in fact, I think we cut the fees exactly in half. So we do not need startup fees for this, and that's the other one of the other reasons why the fee for the registration is set so low. I think I set it at $25 a year on a two-year cycle, or $50 for a two-year license or registration.
Thank you, Mr. McCauley. You had come to me and said that both sides were on agreement on the criminal background check and the education piece. I have not talked to the other side about that, but the significant piece is the registration piece. Is that correct?
That's correct, Representative.
It would be nice if somehow we can keep the good out of in this and then get together and see how you can resolve the rest of it.
We agree, Representative Monica Anderson, that would be good if we could do that. And I think we've unfortunately reached a philosophical point where we see the registration as driving the ability to do the criminal background check and effectively do the education or make sure the education gets done. I have to tell you, we're always open to seeing what we can work out at, you know, through this process. But we have reached that philosophical gulf that we can't get across.
Thank you.
Representative Farrar, did you have another question?
No, I did not.
Any other questions? And finally, how many states have loan originator registration programs like this?
Mr. Chair, there are 9 states that have loan origination or loan originator licensing or registration. Some of them call them licensing. They are Florida, Hawaii, Indiana, Louisiana, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, Texas, and Wisconsin.
Is there any kind of a trend here? I mean, have these been in place for a long time, or are these relatively new?
Mr. Chair, they're relatively new, and I think it reflects the growth in the industry. This is a relatively new industry, and so this is a
Mr. Kruger, do you think there have been problems out there in this industry that do need to be addressed through some kind of a licensing education program similar to what has been proposed?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I think the agency's concern is that a bad player can move from one licensed mortgage lender to another, to another, to another, on the taking the bad habits with them, work for 3, 6, 9 months before, for whatever reason, it comes to the attention of the employer, who then fires him, and then, of course, for various reasons, is reluctant to indicate the reason for the termination when references are checked or if they are checked. I think that is the piece that the agency believes we feel we can be assisted by this bill and that part of it. I don't know that there are large numbers of those people, but I know that they do large damage because of the size of the transactions, the consumers who are involved in the transactions and their personal resources, and the fact that they just keep doing it and we can't prevent it.
Okay, and is it, John, is it fair to say that this bill is an effort to try to clean up what the industry has been concerned about relative to people that people who have been engaged in the industry who have engaged in either unlawful or unethical practices?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's a fair statement. We believe that we need to enhance the professionalism in the organization and establish some standards for the person who deals directly with the consumer.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Crummel? Can I ask a couple questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assume that we're still talking about dash threes as being sort of the bill, correct? Or being the guts of the bill, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummel, the dash three amendments replace the original House Bill 2764, so that is the bill we're talking about.
Okay, I've got a couple questions on there, and I apologize if you've already gone over this and you want me to talk to you afterwards, I can do that. On page 7 of the dash 3s, it talks about supervisor, and it says means an experienced person described in ORS 59850, and then it goes on. What would you describe as experienced?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, that is the statutory reference for the licensee mortgage banker or mortgage broker, and that license application must include identification of, quote, an experienced person that has, was it 3 years experience in the, 3 years? Three in the last 5 years experience in the business. So it is defined in the statute what experienced person means.
Okay. And then it says on, if we go to page 8, it talks about the successful, under 4A, it talks about successfully complete an entry-level training course. Where do you get the training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, there are a number of organizations, private firms that provide this training. The Mortgage Bankers of America has an excellent training program, and these programs would have to be, providers of these programs would have to be certified by the department, but there are many of them out there.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, would your trade association be one of those organizations that would provide training?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, we could. Our anticipation is that we probably won't do a lot of this, that there are enough private providers, private sector providers. We may sponsor a program and invite people to come and hire somebody to come provide that training.
Okay. And then under B, 4B, it says to pass an examination approved by a provider. So that would be a provider of these training programs?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, and that would that provider would have to be approved and certified by the department.
Okay. Moving down the page, in sub six of sub six. Excuse me, on line 23 of page 8. Basically, you have exempted somebody there from having to be registered. And what I'm wondering is why you would do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, this is the language that says that once the entry-level examination is taken, the loan originator has 6 months to complete that entry-level training program.
Okay, but they can still be registered and still be doing loans during that period of time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, that's correct. During that six-month period that they have to complete the entry-level training program, they can be working, correct.
Okay. And then over on thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. Over on page 9, it talks about okay. Why don't I talk to you about the questions that I had rather than continuing on here, and then that way we can, and then there will be some things that we can get done on the record as we need to later. How would that be?
That's fine with me, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony and for answering the questions. We have just a couple of moments before, I understand the Democrats have a caucus, so they have to leave shortly. Is there anybody else that would like to give any testimony on the dash threes? You'd have to be very, very brief. Okay, if not, Representative Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I know that committee members have had a lot of discussion about this particular bill. I know that they've been approached by a lot of parties about this particular bill with different issues. That might be an understatement. This is a personal statement and not a statement to reflect actually any of my colleagues on the committee, whether Democrat or Republican. But everyone has been relatively courteous in coming and making their case on this bill. And I was... I had no problems up until about 1 o'clock today. I have very capable, very competent staff. They have been basically harassed every few minutes today about this bill since about 1 o'clock on. That is actually a way to influence me on a bill, but it's not a way to influence me positively on a bill. I just wanted to put that statement on the record. I don't hold Mr. McCulley responsible for that or the opponents of the bill, but it was the proponents that were doing the harassment. I've worked with Mr. McCulley on a number of different issues, and we've worked together well, and I'm not holding him personally responsible for that. But I know that a number of members have a lot of questions. They want to think a lot of things out about this particular bill. And given that, Mr. Chairman, I've discussed this motion with you, and I believe we have concurrence, and I appreciate your willingness to accept this motion. I'm moving this bill to a time for specific consideration on May 7th, 2001, for public hearing or work session at the discretion of the chair.
Okay, so Representative Devlin is moving this bill to a time certain of May the 7th, that's a Monday, back for work session at the discretion of the chair. Does that address your motion, or restate
yes,
it correctly? Okay, the motion's in front of us. Is there any objection to Representative Devlin's motion? Okay, if not, so ordered. And we are adjourned. Okay, thank you.
Good job.
You want-